and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, rolling high and mighty traps. Pounce with fire on flaming roads, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I, proud neath heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. Half-cracked prejudice leaped forth, ripped down all hate, I screamed. Lies that life is black and white spoke from my skull, I dreamed. Romantic facts of musketeers, foundation deep somehow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who tease. Fearing not that I become my enemy in the instant that I preach. My existence led by confusion boats, mutiny from stern to bow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Yes, my guard stood hard when abstract threats, too noble to neglect, deceived me into thinking I had something to protect. Good and bad, I define these terms, quite clear, no doubt, somehow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. We're all getting younger, aren't we? I've always liked the idea of aging backwards. Merlin was supposed to be living his whole life backwards. That's why he could remember the future, but had no clue what had happened in the past. It's an interesting concept that someone could live backwards. Others have suggested a time-tripping sort of a thing where someone shows up at random moments in time rather than living their life from beginning to end. Vonnegut explored that in Slaughterhouse-Five, and it's been visited in several books and movies. And why not? No, I'm not convinced that our perception of time as a continuous line from birth to death is anything but that, a perception. No more accurate than those famous blind people who get to feel only a small part of the elephant. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we're broadcasting live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's a listener-supported network, and we urge you to visit freedomslips.com and show your support. And now, I am proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome back special guests Phil Ferruccio, Steve Collett, Karen Kitkowski, and Michael Annis. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Port Orange, San Diego, Mount Vernon, Denver, and wherever you are. The American Academy of Letters and Colors, whole numbers, matching things, consonants, fractions, rhyming words, education, and high honors has announced that people should stop reading newspapers, magazines, and immediately stop watching TV news. It's a shame that you even started, to tell you the truth, says the press release document. We mean, what good is all that other stuff if you don't even know this, continues the official press release document. The Academy is offering a National Emergency Homeland Security Doctorate in Liberal Arts and Education and History and Meaning and stuff like that for watching the following documentaries, according to the press release document right here. Recommended, Wellstone, They Killed Him by Snowshoe Films. A Noble Lie, RFK Must Die. Jim Fetzer, What Happened to JFK and Why It Matters Today. Kevin Barrett on the 9/11/2001 attack. The assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King with William Pepper. We Need to Talk About Sandy Hook. The Boston Bombing Hoax, Deep Inside the Rabbit Hole. Charlie Sheen talks about the truth about 9/11. A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, Bart Sabrell. And the Apollo Astronaut Press Conference. To repeat, the American Academy of Letters and Colors, Whole Numbers, Matching Things, Consonants, Fractions, Rhyming Words, Education, and High Honors has announced that people should stop reading newspapers, magazines, and immediately stop watching TV news. It's a shame that you even started, to tell you the truth, says the press release document. We mean, what good is all that other stuff if you don't even know this, continues the official press release document. The Academy is offering an emergency Homeland Security doctorate in liberal arts and education and history and meaning and things like that for watching the following documentaries, according to the press release document here. Recommended, Wellstone, They Killed Him by Snowshoe Films. A Noble Lie. Kill the Messenger. RFK Must Die. Jim Fetzer, What Happened to JFK and Why It Matters Today. Kevin Barrett on the 9/11/2001 attack. The assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King with Dr. William Pepper. We Need to Talk About Sandy Hook. The Boston Bombing Hoax, Deep Inside the Rabbit Hole. Charlie Sheen talks about the truth about 9/11. A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, Bart Sabrell. The Apollo Astronaut Press Conference. Also, the Academy adds that there are more videos you can watch for extra doctorate credit over the summer if you contact their office before you leave for summer break.
Good morning, children. It's time for One Word a Day. Please copy this down in your notebooks. Terrorism. Violence or threats of violence used for intimidation or coercion. So when our government does Oklahoma City and Waco and 9/11, Sandy Hook and Boston, the people in our government who do that are terrorists. The terrorists. Now, please stand for the flag, the Pledge of Allegiance, Aunt Bee's apple pie, the Star-Spangled Banner, Mount Rushmore, the Our Father, the theme from Bonanza, the Statue of Liberty, the U.S. Army, and the NBC Peacock. And now, please join us for another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the lives of real Americans. Last week, we saw a family sleeping off Thanksgiving dinner. Troops up and down the street and in the bushes. The dog got its throat sliced, bleeding out in the roses. This week we see a real live American family next door watching WWE World Wrestling Entertainment. Go Crusher, Go Killer, Go Stinky, Whooping Cough, Yarn Ball, Frecklezilla, Donkey Dong, The Whopper, Megatron, Dixie Destroyer, King, Lulu, and Stubby. Yeah, get him! Yeah! Yeah! Oh, yeah! Tune in next week for another episode of Just Living the Dream, episodes in the lives of real Americans, sponsored by Full Throttle Manly Scented Candles. And now we return to the adventures of Mark. In his parents' basement covered in Cheetos dust, the man who knew too much, conspiracy theory man, the man of La Mancha, the man in the gray flannel pajama bottoms, Jean Valjean, Robin Hood, Holden Caulfield, Tom Joad, Ishmael, Rabbit Angstrom, George Bailey, Jefferson Smith, Frodo Baggins, Yessarian, Harry Potter, Charlie Brown, Calvin and Hobbes, Atticus Finch, Huck Finn, Winston Smith, Mark, in his parents' basement, covered in Cheetos dust. He who can and will change the world, it is his time. He writes on his blog, Cheetos and moon dust are both orange. This new piece he's just completed. The weakest link. If Gene Rosen is a fake, then the whole chain breaks. Then we know that the Bush administration did 9/11 themselves. Then we know that Karl Rove and George Bush cheated, and Bush was never a real president. Then we know that Dick Cheney and the FBI killed Paul Wellstone. Then we know that Oklahoma City was done by the FBI and the Clinton administration. Then we know that Clinton and Reno burned men, women, and children alive on purpose at Waco. Then we know we never went to the moon. Then we know that the CIA killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and John Jr. If Gene Rosen is a fake, then we know that the FBI killed Martin Luther King Jr. We know that Sandy Hook and Aurora and Boston and a dozen other so-called terror events were faked. The weakest link. If Gene Rosen is a fake, then the whole chain breaks. Mark swipes Cheetos dust from his chest, pushes his glasses up tight to his face, and writes, hard to see the dark side is. Do or do not, there is no try. Mark clicks send and listens for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Our first guest of the night is Steve Collett. Steve Collett is a poet, essayist, teacher, workshop facilitator in San Diego. Steve comes to us in the fourth week of every month, and we are very pleased to have him join the show. And Chuck will be getting Steve on the line just right about now. Again, Steve Collett is a poet, essayist, teacher, workshop facilitator, and he lives in the San Diego area.
Hello.
Well, hello, Steve. It's Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Very good. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's a beautiful day here in San Diego. And I thought I would read a poem of my own and talk about things that are going on in the world today that everyone is talking about. You know, people sit around talking about the latest news, and Chris Kyle is in the news, and that whole trial, that weird event that just happened a couple of days ago. And the poem is called Madly Singing in the Mountains. And I want to talk a little bit about it first, because I want everyone to understand what's going on in the poem. I don't write obscure poetry, and I don't read obscure poetry because I don't want to read something I don't understand. I don't read Korean newspapers because I don't speak Korean. And so I want everyone to understand the poem, which is about two friends, me and a dear friend, Fred Morimarco, who passed away 3 years ago this month. A dear friend and I, we used to hike a great deal up in the mountains here in San Diego, up in the Cuyamaca Mountains. And we would both just talk all the time. You know, we'd be chatting about literature. He was a poet. He was a literary critic. He was the chairman of the San Diego State University English Department for a while and had been a professor there for about 30 years. And so he and I would chat about the things we were interested in. And this is about us being in the mountains, talking so much that we're not really seeing anything. And I suspect everyone has had that experience many times. You're out somewhere that's beautiful, but you're engaged in conversation. And every now and then you realize, hey, we're talking so much we haven't even looked around. And Fred and I would have that feeling every now and then, and we'd both laugh, and we'd look around for a few minutes, and then we'd end up going back to our chatting. And so this is a poem about one of those hikes in the Cuyamaca Mountains, when we talk a lot about politics. This was 15, 20 years ago, but I think the politics are very much the same. A few other references. We talked a little bit about science. Schrodinger's cat was about the quantum theory of Schrodinger, that the Copenhagen interpretation didn't make any sense because a cat in a particular thought experiment would end up being both dead and alive at the same time. Bo Chui was a great Chinese poet. Also, by the way, a poet who loved to be perfectly clear. Bo Chui said that he would show his new poems to a neighbor of his, a peasant woman. And if she could understand the poem, then he knew he was going in the right direction. And he wouldn't let the poem go until she understood it. A few other references in here to science or whatever. Tracy Lords, as most people remember, was a very young porn star 15 or so years ago. And the poem is called Madly Singing in the Mountains, which in fact is the title of a poem by the great poet Bo Chui. And it's to my dear friend Fred Mormonko, who passed away 3 years ago this month. Who I used to go hiking with, and the poem goes like this. Fred Morimarco and I had been hiking up in the Cuyamacas, lost in our usual babble, boring more holes in the world than the woodpeckers do, talking the angels out of their halos, the muses out of their tutus, the world into marshmallow pudding. From post-deconstructionist theory and newfangledness in poetics, we'd moved on to Salvadoran death squads and low-intensity warfare, the legions of evangelical zealots out in the streets agitating for more executions, compulsory prayer, ironclad regulations against miscegenation and condoms, a jihad against homosexual teachers, the ACLU, and the Bob Dylan songbook. They wanted fellatio outlawed, the braceros deported, the fossil records revoked. The trail we'd been hiking had swung northwest through stands of black oak, till suddenly it opened onto a ridge and we stepped through a tunnel of branches into broad daylight. The sky impossibly blue, east mountains that rolled on forever, west where the light was hazier still, the mesa dissolving into a mist we supposed was the coast. Fred thought he could almost make out the ocean, though at that distance, in that light, whatever was out there had faded into the gray Pacific wash of the void. One of those moments when, stunned by the infinite, everything stops. Jesus, Fred sighed, I'm glad we got out here today. And I nodded, yeah, me too, me too. And before we even knew we had been there, we're back into Jimmy Swaggart and Schrodinger's cat, the friendship of Bo Chui and Wan Chen, those child prodigies, Mozart, Arthur Rimbaud, and Tracy Lords. No fault divorce, every moment awareness, Muji, the first gate, the marriage of chaos and form and the hypothetical origins of carbon-based life. In such manner, making our way to where Green Valley Falls tumbles into the Sweetwater River Canyon. We too, merrily babbling away, tongues like party streamers in high wind, delighted, oblivious, full steam ahead. So that's a little sort of comic poem about an occasion of being with a dear friend, hiking, and every now and then realizing that we got so engrossed in our conversation that we weren't able to see where we were in this beautiful, very precious and fragile world. Fred, as I said, passed away 3 years ago, and we had been hiking up there several times a year for many, many, many years. And we were always having these conversations, and nothing much has changed in America and the world. The legions of evangelical zealots are still there out on the streets, especially now that a new presidential election is beginning, and we hear the same nonsense that we heard before this very week. For example, I believe in Kansas, there's a new bill that looks like it's going to be passed as a law that anyone, and it's especially for teachers, who puts up a poster with inappropriate material can spend 6 months in prison. Apparently what happened is some teacher in a middle school put up a poster about sex, in which there was a list of how people satisfy sexual cravings, kissing and hugging and so on and so forth. And one of the terms on this poster was anal sex. And the teacher was reprimanded, of course, and it made headline news in Kansas. And because of that, a bill is now being considered that, as I say, looks like it's going to pass, which would give that teacher, for having put that poster up in a middle school classroom, as much as 6 months in prison. We love prisons in this culture. We are the most prison-happy culture on the planet Earth. We have, I don't remember the statistics, but it looks like we have, I think, one quarter of all the prisoners in the entire world are in American prisons. And we have longer prison sentences than I believe any other nation on Earth. And there's a movement now, an interesting movement among politicians, probably because it's costing so much money to have all these prisons, to start reducing prison sentences so that people don't go away for 20 years for a minor crime that had nothing to do with violence. You know, we put people away if they're three-time or four-time losers for life. In California, certainly, we do that for, I believe, four-time losers, as they're called. And we have this insane but very lucrative prison system. And, of course, now that prisons are being privatized, it's even better for the people who own the prisons if we have more and more people in there for a longer and longer period. The fellow who killed Chris Kyle, this fellow Eddie Ray Ralph, as you all know, was convicted of murder for killing him and his friend Chad Littlefield, even though this fellow is clearly a paranoid schizophrenic, a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, someone who has medications, who is taking medications for it, whose motives for murdering these two guys were out to help him. You know, the movie about Chris Kyle is how wonderful it is to go to Iraq and murder those dirty, rotten towel heads, those dirty, rotten Arabs. We are a very racist country, and after all these years, the majority of Americans still don't get the fact that we had absolutely no reason to invade that country or Afghanistan, and that the Iraqi people have under international law every right to pick up arms to repel a foreign invasion and occupation of their country. So everyone who this moron, Chris Kyle, killed, murdered, because it is murder, was defending their country against a foreign invasion. But Americans, and it's not only Americans, the human brain is capable of enormous levels of stupidity, especially when it's comforting and convenient to be stupid. And so instead of realizing that we had no right to invade this country or Afghanistan or Pakistan, we are the heroes after all then. And we're the good guy, even though they were not going to attack the United States, and we now know Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction George Bush swore up and down that they had, and we went in there and we hanged Saddam Hussein, who had been a great U.S. ally for about 30 years. We had induced him to go to war with Iran. We had given him all the weapons he has. We had given him the most lethal of weapons to hopefully destroy Iran. The United States is the great terrorist nation on this planet. We are the problem. We are not the solution. And so the things I talk about in this poem of 20 years ago are still very much the case today. I talk about the Salvadoran death squads. Well, we're now trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela, which we did when Hugo Chavez was president, and we're doing it again with Maduro, because they don't take orders from the United States. In any country that does not take orders from the United States is in danger of having hundreds of thousands of their citizens slaughtered by U.S. bombs. And the U.S. people, the American people, go to movies like American Sniper, and they applaud and they love them, and they say, oh, what a wonderful movie. This should have won 12 Academy Awards. How patriotic. Patriotism is something we need to get over. Patriotism just says, my country is right, and I don't care about the facts. It's dangerous. Don't salute the flag anymore is my advice. Thank you very much, and I'm delighted to be on this show.
Thank you, Steve. Good night.
Good night.
The Dan Rather Award for What Passes for Journalism in This Country will be presented next week. The coveted bronze statue of a mockingbird will be bestowed at the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. Engraved on the statue, most consumers of the corporate media were and are unaware of the effect that the salting of public opinion has on their own beliefs. A little bit about the history of the prized award. Dan Rather started his career being center stage and instrumental in selling the JFK hoax. Go to YouTube and watch American Sweetheart TV anchorman Dan Rather as he relates what he knows of the yet unreleased Zapruder film only 3 days after the JFK drama. According to Rather, his head could be seen to move violently forward. Dan Rather's job here seems to be to plant the earliest seeds of free shots, and the car never stopped. It never paused. He then went on to being chief pitchman of the 9/11 hoax. A few years later, he was fired for speaking the truth on Bush's military record. So Dan gets away with telling the two biggest lies of the last 50 years, but is fired for reporting on a relatively minor or irrelevant event. One might think Dan finally got a conscience and decided to spill the beans on the great deceptions, but no. It was simply a distraction or another false event illustrating the fake power struggle between government and media. There is no power struggle. The two work hand in glove together. Rather says, albeit falsely, to my fellow journalists, in places where reporting the truth means risking it all. The only positive thing about the decline of network TV anchors with the rise of the internet is this. At least Americans won't be letting the deceivers into their living room on a daily basis anymore. Their time has passed. What a run they had, though, leading the deception for so long. The Dan Rather Award for what passes for journalism in this country, also engraved in the bronze Mockingbird statue in fine print upside down, so dusty on the bottom. A lie can travel halfway around the world, while the truth is putting on its shoes.
We're presenting a truth book series, Save the World, Resist the American Empire. The first book, The Dynamic Duo, a biography of Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, is completed and available. And in process is a book showing that nobody died at Sandy Hook or Boston. Next will come a book that will explore the questions of whether we went to the moon and whether the Holocaust happened as we're being told. Also, whether Paul McCartney, the real one, died a long time ago. The fourth book will show that nuclear weapons were used by Israel and persons within the U.S. government on the World Trade Center towers, and that the U.S. media is guilty of being an integral part of a domestic Operation Gladio, and cataloging and explaining the rash of United States false flag, false terror events in recent years. The entire series, entitled Save the World, Resist the American Empire, is scheduled for release this year, 2015. And back now for a moment to the first book in our series, which is currently available, The Dynamic Duo, White Rose Blooms in Wisconsin, Kevin Barrett, Jim Fetzer, and the American Resistance. On February 22, 1943, Sophie Scholl, Hans Scholl, and Christoph Probst were executed for their role in urging students to rise up and overthrow the Nazi government. They were members of a group called the White Rose, who organized nonviolent resistance to Hitler, and were arrested for printing and distributing anti-Nazi flyers. A whole new form of government is going to take over the country. Jack Ruby. That's what it was, wasn't it? We expected something like what we'd been born with, as if it were always going to be there, but it was gone. We started out spoiled. All this stuff going on, running full blast, riding a bike down the street with no hands, arms outstretched. We didn't even see the wall. Can you believe the Warren Commission? I mean, believe that it really happened and we did not have riots because of it, but rather we just say, oh, well. And so, Bush fought the 9/11 Commission. He did not want to testify alone. Was the commission meeting in the dark with spiders? After 9/11, all the propaganda to promote the war, terror alerts, where did those go? Osama bin Laden tapes in the middle of the afternoon on Fox and CNN and NBC. 9/11 commission, finally, and then what a supreme joke that was. And we settled for it. Building 7, controlled demolition. Where's the plane in the Pentagon? Shanksville, dancing Israelis. And still the Bushes ride in a golf cart down the third base line, waving to the crowd, and are greeted by cheers rather than tomatoes, fists, and handcuffs. Karl Rove, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney walk free. Condoleezza Rice teaches at Stanford rather than being locked up forever in one of those high-tech concentration camps we have, like in Florence, Colorado, and shuffling off to the shower each morning wearing ankle shackles and a waist chain and fluorescent orange pajamas for the rest of their lives. If we're going to have these insane places, we might as well put the worst of the worst there. That would be George and George Bush, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, and whatever other dozens have conspired continue to conspire to overthrow this country, who know the truth and don't tell the rest of us, FBI Director Mueller, General Tommy Franks, and all the other generals who acted as commentators on NPR and Fox, ensuring us that the coming war was so cool, so good, so right. And now we have how many hundreds of thousands of dead human beings in Iraq and Afghanistan? Just people who were living their lives and found themselves in the way of the American quest for gold, for dominance. And the thousands of young Americans who have died or had their lives ruined because of a lie, a huge, amazing lie perpetrated by men and women we asked in good faith to lead us on our way. Bush, Obama, Card, Clinton, Fleischer, Wolfowitz, Ashcroft, Pearl, O'Reilly, Hannity, Couric, Lauer, Williams, Rather, Jennings, Brokaw, Limbaugh, Blitzer, Sawyer, Rivera, all those names, who, if history ever writes itself, will be synonymous with Goebbels, Goering, Himmler. Our history stems from that day, from that place. From November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m., Dallas, Texas. Memphis, Los Angeles, Oklahoma City, New York City, Washington, D.C., Eveleth, Minnesota, Aurora, Sandy Hook, Boston, Fallujah, Kabul, Kandahar, and whatever is happening right now, what is coming, unless we stop it, us, you, me, we. Who was really behind the anthrax attacks? Isn't it important, at least as important as Paul Revere's ride or a cracked bell? Have you ever Googled JFK assassination at 11:30 at night and then found yourself still on the computer in the living room when the family's getting up for school and work? We used to make a wish upon a star, daydream that when we die, we would ask the very first thing after we set down our suitcases, who killed JFK? But now, thanks to the tears and sweat and blood of Jim Fetzer, Kevin Barrett, and many others, we can save that wish, keep that one big question for something else, because we already know that one. Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett do not face being beheaded by a guillotine in the basement of the county building on the corner of Main and First. Not that we know of. If someone finds out about their writings or hears their radio shows or sees them speak at a public gathering, that's not the American means of beheading. An American cuts off your head at your neck by taking away the ball. It's his anyway. Not allowing you to play. By rolling his eyes at you as you pass on the street. As he passes the stuffing across the Thanksgiving table, interviews you on national television. You may live here, die here. You'll be free to do what you want, say what you want, but we will speak no more about you. That's how it has gone all these years in America, at least since November 23rd, 1963. But still, there are those who care enough to try a full court hook shot with time running out, and they are heroes, whether that shot goes in or not. The White Rose students wrote leaflets, words, and distributed them and were considered worthy of decapitation by the government. Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett write and speak, making their education, experience, ideas, and opinions available to as many people as they can. And no doubt they are also known by those in power. They are a face of the resistance in America, which does exist in many forms. The resistance in America has a long and storied history, from the Wobblies and socialists and all those who fought and died and wrote and spoke and suffered and sang and shouted for workers' rights, against war, women's rights, for the earth. Since the first white man stepped foot on this land, nudged the white man standing next to him and said that this was now their land. And all the way up, from Ammon Hennessy, Dorothy Day, Peter Morin, Emma Goldman, so many names unknown to American school children and now American adults, up through the now famous resistors of the 1960s, famous because of their acts and courage, and also because the American media at that time was not yet so much a part of the state, not yet Tass and his bestia. But those holes in the wall were soon filled in. We do not know of the Plowshares heroes. We do not know the names Helen Woodson, Carl Cabot, Larry Cloud Morgan, Paul Cabot, Frank Cordero, many, many others. Why aren't the blue-collar words of Bill Berrigan etched below his smiling statue in Washington, D.C.? The tourists can climb on, sit on, take their photos, and the poetry of his brother Daniel etched in stone above the entrance of the Supreme Court. Their names, many faces as ghostly and invisible as the dead faces of the brown people in El Salvador, Guatemala, Iraq, Afghanistan. Does anyone know the names Kevin McGuire, Gene Peterson, Daryl Rupiper, Larry Rosebaugh, Roy Bourgeois, Megan Rice, Greg Borchi-Obed, Michael Wally, Brian Terrell? No. All are members of the American White Rose, resistors to the empire, unknown to their countrymen, yet very real. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government, like a horror movie, and the killer is in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us, and they want us to be afraid. We cannot be afraid. The great city sprawls with people, some smartly dressed, many of them shabby, a few beautiful, but most not, all reduced by the towering structures around them to the size of insects, but scuttling, hurrying, intent in the milky morning sun upon some plan or scheme or hope they're hugging to themselves, their reason for living another day. Each one of them impaled live upon the pin of consciousness, fixed upon self-advancement and self-preservation. That, and only that. That's by John Updike from The Terrorist. That's perhaps the human condition. Forced to find a reason for living another day, impaled live upon the pin of consciousness to become fixed upon self-advancement and self-preservation. But the human condition also means knowing when there's something wrong, something not quite right, and having the spirit to refuse to live like that, to live within a lie. That's why so many people have worked for so long, for 10 years, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, against all sorts of obstacles to find the truth, to make this the country and we, the people, we always assumed we were. Common people, educated people who have set this puzzle down, spread it out over the whole kitchen table, and began working on it for years and years. New people drift in the door and take their place. People like Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer, who have been working nonstop for years, to give us that new American dream. They are not afraid. We take courage from their example. The entire series, Save the World, Resist the Empire by CWG Press. Available by visiting cwgpress.com or looking on Amazon. The entire series will be available this year, 2015.
Thank you, Chuck. Our next guest of the evening was scheduled to be Karen Kitkowski. Karen is not able to be with us tonight. So what I thought I would do is to mention or to read a piece from Penn Jones Jr. in the spirit of what Chuck just read about the book about Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer. Penn Jones Jr. is a hero of mine. I never met him. He was a reporter in Texas. He ran a small town paper in Midlothian, Texas. And what he did was he reported on the Kennedy assassination, and he reported it from the bully pulpit of a small town newspaper. And I think it's just so amazing that what he did was just to, you know, he didn't run the New York Times. He ran the Midlothian, Texas newspaper. You know, it's not that far from Dallas, but it was just a small town, and he just did it. And anyway, something that he did was he wrote a book, and he published it somehow. And he probably wrote more than one book, but this book was called Forgive My Grief. And this is just the foreword, and I'll go as far as I can with the time I have. I have about 5, 6, or 7 minutes until the music comes on, I'll read. But what I'm reading from, again, is Forgive My Grief by Penn Jones Jr., and it's regarding the people, and he was one of the first ones to discover the pattern of all the witnesses to the Kennedy assassination meeting untimely deaths. He was the first one to discover that. Anyway, this is a foreword. Now, anyone can know, if he wants to know, that the conclusions of the Warren Commission are a gigantic fraud. History will record that when his country needed him most, Earl Warren went AWOL. The commission members, the attorneys, the investigative agencies were predetermined that the president was killed by one man with one gun. Their mouths opened and closed on cue. The agencies hid or revealed evidence as their plot demanded. 1 week, evidence was solemnly presented. The next week, the same evidence was solemnly denied. We don't know all of the story yet, but we know much more than we did 18 months ago when Forgive My Grief, Volume 1 was published. A few of us continue to probe and prove, bit by tiny bit. The pieces of the puzzle are being put into place. The going is slow, for we are opposed by the federal government. We are opposed by the Dallas police. Most shamefully of all, we are opposed by the American press. On that Black Friday afternoon, as information on trapped and hapless Lee Oswald poured in from all over the world, a reporter asked an FBI agent in Dallas how the FBI had collected and disseminated so much information on Oswald in such an amazingly short time. The answer was simple. We use computers. The answer was simple, but it was simply not true. The police did not use computers. They didn't need to. The FBI and CIA were so deeply involved with Oswald, they knew the story. We, however, still desperately need the use of computers. If we could have the use of a modern computer and an honest programmer, feed the 26 volumes in the archives material into the computer, plus the facts dug up by our small band known as the Critics, we might soon know the entire story. If the computer could not point to the culprits at this stage of the investigation, instant recall of all the facts surely might permit the computer to point out the proper direction for further investigative work. We have read that the Sunday Times of London presented 15 of the strange deaths to an actuary with a computer to determine the chances of all 15 of them being dead 3 years after the assassination. The odds came back 100,000 trillion to one against all of them being dead within 3 years. The charges repeatedly made that we are pursuing this investigation just to make money Our book has lost money, but that is strictly our problem. Investigative work is expensive. It has taken much traveling and searching for this writer to become convinced that the mafia did not participate in the killing of President Kennedy. The mafia refused a contract to kill the president, but the mafia has killed some of the people who have died so strangely since the assassination. These killings were purely a financial arrangement between the mafia and those interested in seeing that some of the most important witnesses died. The assassination mystery is so important that every American citizen should become involved. Every citizen should read enough of the 26 volumes to be able to decide from firsthand knowledge whether he believes or disbelieves the commission's story. Yet that is impossible. There are only 8,000 sets of the record in print for a nation of 190 million people. We have 10,000 libraries in this country, so it is obviously impossible for each library to have one set of the 26 volumes. If our people are to know the record, we need a massive reprint of the volumes immediately. We need at least 100,000 sets, preferably in paperback, so they might be sold more cheaply than the present price of $76. We need the materials now. We need informed Americans to act now. As editor M.S. Arnone reminds us, Rome was at the height of her power when she fell. This democracy is in danger. Penn Jones, Jr. And I'll continue, but I won't get very far. But again, this is Penn Jones, Jr., a legendary journalist from Midlothian, Texas, talking about the JFK murder, which is still important today. The number one deaths. The unsolved assassination of President John F. Kennedy continues to baffle the world. Within 3 years after that Black Friday, at least 24 persons who became accidentally involved have died. Most died violently, shot, hanged, karate chop death, throat slit. Others had suicides arranged by shooting, poisoning, and other means. This writer discovered the connections in the deaths of the many witnesses and other persons associated with the assassination. We have not previously listed all these people who have died so young and so strangely. With the mounting list of these deaths, the likelihood grows that these people have been systematically and skillfully eliminated. We told of the death of 6'3", 250-pound Thomas Henry Hank Killam in his 40s in Volume 1. Hank had moved from town to town after the assassination and then from state to state in an effort to avoid the continual questioning of federal agents. According to Hank's wife, Wanda Joyce Killam, who had worked for Jack Ruby for the past 2 years, Hank was hounded from job to job by these federal agents. And I'll stop there. And again, that's Penn Jones with Forgive My Grief about the mysterious deaths following the JFK assassination. And the JFK assassination is obviously still important to us today.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida, with stops at Information Clearinghouse, Dandelion Salad, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and many others, here is Phil Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Good evening, Working Stiffs. Did you ever see the pictures of the 1930s, the Great Depression, the signs for foreclosures and for rent and for lease all over the place? Well, I took a ride around my area here in Port Orange. I've been doing this lately. And all I see, I don't know where you live, if you see the same thing, I'm sure you do. All I see are for rent, for lease, for commercial space all over. Mom and pop businesses are going under like crazy. We are in a depression. The media, the politicians, Mr. Obama and his stooges and the Congress will never, ever tell you the truth. But I'm telling you the truth. We're not in a recession. We're in a depression. All right? And it's sad because if you look at the all the strip malls in my town, for instance, they're all owned by big corporations, usually from out of state, or at least from out of this area. And it's funny because the government gives tax breaks. I don't know whether you know this or not, but the government gives tax breaks for a landlord of commercial space if he cannot rent the space. Unrented commercial space, they can write it off. Now, I had a mom-and-pop business for a couple of years. Did they let me write off when my sales went down? Did I get a tax break? No. Mom-and-pops get screwed by these corporations charging high rents. They don't care if the economy is doing bad. They keep the rents high, just like they do with the residential property. Why? Because they can write it off if it's unrented. That law has to be changed, and we have to make waves with our politicians telling them, stop letting landlords write off for unrentable space. It's not fair, and it hurts the economy. So we're in a depression. You look around. The number one employer is Walmart. How much are these people making a year? Let's go by the hour. If they're lucky, they make, what, $9, $10, $11 an hour? 8 hours a day, $11 an hour. Let's do the math. It's $88 a day. 5 days a week, that's $440 a week. The rent for the residential space where I live, a one-bedroom apartment, minimum is probably, for just a low-end apartment, is $600 a month, just for an apartment. Two-bedroom, if you have a couple of kids, you're looking at $800, $850 a month. You want to rent a house, which is happening a lot now because these corporations are buying up all the foreclosed homes and turning them into rental property. Where I live, just for a single two-bedroom house in a regular, you know, working-class neighborhood, they're getting $1,100, $1,200 a month. So you have a single mom or a single dad raising one kid. He's making or she's making $11, $12 an hour. They're making $440 to $500 a week. That's $25,000 a year. Their rent is minimum $600 to $800 a month. Then you have to factor in all the expenses, clothing, gasoline, food, phone bill, car payment. Now let's go to car payments. New loans on cars average a record 67.2 months at an average interest rate of 4.5%. That's what they just came out, these stats. It says here that the average transaction price of a new vehicle was $32,300. I don't know how anybody making even $30,000 a year could afford a $32,000 car. Subprime and deep subprime borrowers, those with credit ratings of 500 to 600 and 300 to 500, respectively, they account for 20% of all borrowers. So that means that one out of five people that are buying a car are probably getting hit with anywhere from 8 to 9% interest rates in order to have that car. We are in a depression, and it's time for you folks out there to understand it and to get angry about it, okay? The government, as Mark Twain said, was here to protect us from the crooks and scoundrels. Well, the corporations, the banks, the your mortgage people are the crooks and the scoundrels. So I say, working stiffs, let's get wise and let's get a little bit angry. Thank you and good night.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polachek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the
blizzard. Half of our nation, by all reasonable estimates of human need, is in poverty. A recent Bankrate poll found that almost two-thirds of Americans didn't have savings available to cover a $500 repair bill or a $1,000 emergency room visit. A related Pew survey concluded that over half of U.S. households have less than 1 month's income in readily available savings, and that all their savings, including retirement funds, amounted to only 4 months of income. Over half of Americans have good reason to feel poor. Between 2007 and 2013, median wealth dropped a shocking 40%, leaving the poorest half with negative wealth because of debt, and a full 60% of households owning in total about as much as the nation's 94 richest individuals. People of color fare the worst, with half of black households owning less than $11,000 in total wealth, and Hispanic households less than $14,000. The median net worth for white households is about $142,000. Official poverty measures are based largely on the food costs of the 1950s. But food costs have doubled since 1978. Housing has more than tripled, and college tuition is 11 times higher. The cost of raising a child increased by 40% between 2000 and 2010, and health care expenses continue to grow. As all these essential costs have been going up, median household income has been going down since 2000, with the greatest drop occurring since 2009. As 95% of the post-recession income gains have gone to the richest 1%. According to the Federal Reserve Bank, there have been job gains at the highest paid level, engineering, finance, computer analysis, and there have been job gains at the lowest paid level, personal health care, retail, and food preparation. But the jobs that kept the middle class out of poverty, education, construction, social services, transportation, administration, have seen a decline since the recession, especially in the Northeast. At a national level, jobs gained are paying 23% less than jobs lost. Worse yet, the lowest paid workers, those in housekeeping and home health care and food service, have seen their wages drop 6 to 8%. Over half of public school students are poor enough to qualify for lunch subsidies. There's been a stunning 70% increase since the recession in the number of children on food stamps. State of Working America reported that almost half of black children under the age of 6 are living in poverty. The celebratory quotes about a booming economy seem so far away.
That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. Stay classy, San Diego. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table, and never make direct eye contact with a policeman. Our next guest of the evening is Michael Annis. Chuck will be getting Michael on the phone right about now. Michael is a publisher and poet, and he comes to us each fourth week of each month from Denver, Colorado. Mike is a publisher, the executive editor, publisher of Howling Dog Press in Denver, Colorado. Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Well, hi, Chuck and Mike. I'm glad to be back. Well, I'm going to start, pick up where I left off a couple months ago. We had kind of an intermission from this. Brave New World Order. We left off with part 6. I'm going to read Brave New World Order part 7 tonight. Brave New World Order. Ironically, what had come into being as a protective rationale to thwart the fears of man had become, through a very short course of time, far less than eternal, even far less than an eon, the source of his greatest tyranny and dehumanization. The initiates knew that this religion could not be stripped from the workers, for their sufferings were so great in this life that the prospect of having no afterlife to look forward to would make their sufferings unbearable. And the saliva of extortion foamed at the corners of the initiate's mouth, anticipating the power of total control and the ease with which that power would be achieved and sustained. Measures were taken by order of the overlords. They continually re-rationalized the former religions, inventing more sophisticated replacements to keep the workers dragging the same ship out of the same harbor generation after generation. The workers were taught to believe in a strange god, a god of fear and punishment, one who would who would, in his unappeased indignation, confiscate the very soul. You thought you had nothing up until now, just you wait sort of God, who created a race of the eternally guilty and poverty-ridden and grateful for it. And even when mercy, compassion, and forgiveness entered into the holy handshakes, writings, and sermons, lurking in the background in the undertow of each emancipated soul was the belief of everlasting condemnation and the eternal pain of unfathomable suffering smirking cruelly like demon monkeys in the tormented cellar of the human psyche. And though these systems of imprisonment via the word were once, now and again, challenged, those who had become true believers and stewards of the key to the ever-narrowing in the false pretense of expanding cells strayed not for fear of consequences in a nebulous, ill-defined afterlife where one had all the time in a heavenly eternity or a series of hellish reincarnations to go round and round with the same tragic problems one experienced before death, as each generation viewed heaven through the eyes and minds of its own generation, where heaven was constructed of its own fallacies, prejudices, and superstitions. Ergo, if you died as an English Victorian, your heaven that awaited you was English Victorian, with a little ancient Hebrew thrown in to make it seem magical and authentic, and Jack the Ripper awaiting from the shadows those who had strayed from the true way. Paradoxically, as they long for rewards after death, they punish those who would take their own lives to achieve death, decreeing places of eternal torment and damnation awaited them. And if their attempts at rehabilitation were unsuccessful, and a free thinker on his path to damnation continued freely thinking, constructed places of temporal torment here and now, prisons, concentration camps, and islands of dead and dying leprous souls. For the supreme objective was not emancipation of the human mind and spirit, but rather to thrust the span and the mass of the human psyche backwards through the immovable, irreversible stations of the double cross, wherein inquisitions exploded from the muzzles of guns in the crosshairs of violent conquest, and human being was separated from human being by the razor sharpness of the sword. The religions of great human sacrifice, to take the power of another's mind, to eat another's heart, to suck up another's individuality, all the proud, noble, terrified masses of the earth dancing in their tribes, dancing to dam up the violence of genes gone awry through fear, drumming to drown out the terror of where it was that they occupied within the anguish of their own damaged hearts, chanting to suppress the horror of expulsion, prove that even through the bloody course of millennia of civilizations recycling recycled civilizations, at the center of the universe was still the God of human sacrifice, perpetuated eternally by the religious shamans and politicians of the initiates, with the disinherited workers in grateful, if not murky, obeisance as their unwitting collaborators, dying like vermin of their own extinctions in the dust collecting at the feet of supervisor footstools and in the ashes upon overlord altars, for they did not understand that the power of the universe was already imbued within their DNA, and even the slightest glimpse of this knowledge was kept from them in the most classified of all classified information, which had become the tool to perpetuate overlord dominance and control. Under the watchful, glaring eye of this strange god, the overlords divided the workers with planned and planted racial wars, untranslatable dialects, political systems built on disinformation and decoy, dogmatic and obdurate theologies, economic rivalries that created clandestine economic censorship, and grassroots plain and petty hatreds shored up and reinforced through the pain and suffering of the common man, continuously circling the drain of life, awaiting the great sucking sound that thrust him down, then out. They condition workers to believe that various forms of the word, particularly that which manifested in music, art, literature, science, and philosophy, were intrinsically evil, and therefore should be repressed, systematically censored, and outlawed from the masses. While supervisor evils were cultivated, refined, exhorted, and enraptured, as true evil became the evil which postured itself as a state of grace and affluence. And each generation inculcated this into each generation that followed. Yet the gravest deletion, the most sinister omission of knowledge, that knowledge considered to be holy, shared only among the elite as the inner vital core of the sacred mysteries, that knowledge which would have liberated workers and, in fact, all of humanity to become not only a new and greater species, but actually at one with the universe and life itself, was the fact that what the term word meant was each species' DNA. For DNA was language itself. DNA was the word. DNA was the force and the perfected mind, having its own thoughts, having its own destiny. The language riding on rarefied frequencies of light drove and propelled the evolution and completion of each species' destiny and the destiny of life itself. Therefore, in darkness, superstition, and ignorance, the masses remained, and human genes bonded with the sadomasochistic monsters which sought to destroy them, and man existed as a mythic beast unto himself, ravenous, terrifying, who haunted his own life, hunting down every notion of peace, justice, love, and tranquility with the hounds of fear and the lust for riches. End of part 7.
Michael, that continues to be a fascinating piece.
Well, thank you, Chuck.
Since it has been a while, could you very briefly remind the listeners what it is, where it came from?
Well, Brave New World Order was actually an essay interstitially created by myself. It's an interstitial creative nonfiction that I began in 1991-92 as a reaction, essentially, to what I saw that was a continual exploitation of people, of common people, by those people who had managed to achieve some form of either political or economic power, and was those people were in continually exploiting, like I say, exploiting the masses to essentially do their bidding, as they have done throughout history. It became clearer and clearer to me that it was almost like an entire mythology that had been created in which people existed. And I used the subtitle of Man is a Myth Unto Himself, Brave New World Order, Man is a Myth Unto Himself. All right. The title itself was taken from Aldous Huxley's, not just his original science fiction piece, which was Brave New World, but what I considered to be even a greater piece, which followed is a sequel based more on fact, was Huxley's Brave New World Revisited, and I would recommend that everybody read that. I mean, it's timeless. I mean, it was first published in the early 1950s. I still reread Brave New World Order Revisited because it was so prescient, the way that Huxley foresaw all of the things economic, politically, that were coming down, through not just through England or the United States, But just coming down into the world as a whole, what was going to transpire and how people were going to end up as really essentially slaves of a system, and a system that was corrupt, and it was always set up for a very few people. Then I took...
That's our signal, Michael. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us each month. We really appreciate it.
And now a message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From Sally in Sicily, it is the function of the CIA to keep the world unstable and to propagandize the American people to hate. So we will let the establishment spend any amount of money on arms. From Dave in Smallville, even open-minded people will often find themselves unable to take seriously the likes of Jim Fetzer, Kevin Barrett, James Tracy on first encountering their work. It just does not seem possible that we could be so mistaken in what we believe. The individual may assume that these writers must be somehow joking, loudly overstating the case, paranoid, or have some sort of axe to grind. We may actually become angry with them for telling us these terrible things about our society and insist that this simply can't be true. It takes real effort to keep reading, to resist the reassuring messages of the mass media and be prepared to consider the evidence again. And from Sue in Roslyn, the corporate grip on opinion in the United States is one of the wonders of the Western world. No first world country has ever managed to eliminate so entirely from its media all objectivity, much less dissent. A message in a Boone's Farm bottle, some notes I have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. And now Lee Herrick. Lee Herrick is a poet, writer, and recording artist in Minneapolis. First, I'm going to read a piece of hers, and then we're going to hear her speak, a recording where she will be speaking her own poem, telling her own poem, reciting her own poem. This is called Memorial, Senator Paul Wellstone, October 20th, 2012, by Lee Herrick. I am thinking today of the upcoming 10th anniversary of the Wellstone plane crash. Senator Paul Wellstone, our senator from Minnesota, was killed October 25th, 2002. The last time I saw Paul Wellstone was in the fall of 2000 during a conference for the Center of Victims of Torture at the Earl Brown Heritage Center in Minneapolis. There were various workshops being held as the center was about to release its new tactics and human rights workbook, a workbook I had assisted in editing over Labor Day weekend 1999 as a volunteer for the center. As such, I'd been invited to dine with employees, attend workshops, and listen to the breakfast guest speakers, one of whom was Senator Wellstone. When the senator had finished, he made his way across the banquet room toward the doors, stopped by all those who wanted to shake his hand, share a word or two. I let him walk past me, knowing he was pressed for time and feeling essentially too shy to stop him for any greeting. Still, he looked at me, ready to stop if I'd made way for him. I just smiled, and he nodded, smiling back. I regret to have never thanked him for all his hard work. I'm sure I assumed there would be another time. There wasn't. 2002 was a terrible year if you weren't pumped up to see Americans engage in yet another war. While Bush, too, was ramping up his rhetoric to do just that, the U.S. lost two important and critical voices against the war, the poet June Jordan and Senator Wellstone, who died with seven others, including his wife Sheila, a champion of human rights dedicated to bringing attention to and ending domestic violence, and their daughter, Marcia. Wellstone's plane mysteriously crashed 2 miles from the Evelyn Airport in Minnesota. If I had been disappointed by Wellstone casting his vote for the Patriot Act, I was relieved he remained the ever-progressive hero by voting nay when it came to going to war with Iraq. Wellstone delivered, and their hope for the country was modeled for those of us who understood the risks, the costs, and that retribution, the eye for eye, was a fundamentalist perspective not befitting U.S. foreign policy even if it satisfied a portion of the conservative base. In the 2002 Senate race, Wellstone would have tipped congressional power on the side of Democrats. Just days away from the Senate election, with Wellstone favored to win, his plane went down. It was a JFK moment. I remember where I was, how I looked at my husband, how my stomach turned. In the living rooms of privacy, we all talked. We all said the word. I remember believing as I attended protest rallies in St. Paul and Washington, D.C., as we edged nearer then entered into engagement. I remember believing as I walked the Lake Street Bridge with other activists, as I got my Say No to War with Iraq sign. I remember actually believing those of us who wished to do so would actually stop Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. We would keep U.S. troops from having to engage in a war whose need was entirely steeped in that fictional need formed of lies. We would save the people in Iraq from having to endure further suffering beyond sanctions through the oncoming American military might that would lethally pose as and otherwise utterly displace effective foreign policy. Unfortunately, the propaganda campaign was effective, and most Americans chose to believe it was just to send American troops into war. There was a lot of talk about just war. Opinions abounded, and critical thinking landed dead, vilified in the vociferous area of public opinion, and there was nothing I could do. When Wellstone died, we went to his campaign headquarters on University Avenue, where flowers and signs lay in mounds, where messages were written out on large makeshift cards and candles burned in votives. The people walked by one another silently, some weeping softly. We did not greet each other, though we seemed to hold our vigil in appreciation as something sacred and silent presence in witness of. And now, Lee Herrick reading her poem, Memorial, University Avenue, St. Paul.
So this poem is titled Memorial, University Avenue, St. Paul, which can be found in my book, Homefront, Poems of the Bush 2 Years. Last night, the wax of war still dripping, still running everywhere, running in streets and highways, running through deserts and forests, mountains and fields, along the back roads and alleys, and near the unnamed creeks of infamy. Last night, through living rooms and salons and local cafes, running through speakers and headsets and the minds of those who are afraid. Last night, among so many candles lit and going out or out at last. Last night, as the wax of war ran on in Jenin and Ramallah, in Baghdad and Jakarta. Last night in Moscow and Bali, in Manila and Florida. Last night in New York City and from under the Lake Street Bridge, running and dripping, forming together in pools that solidify like men in the school of the Americas. Last night, as war waxed on, immersed in the floods and tricklings of its ever-specified mentality. Last night, the Ethiopians said goodbye. Latino union workers said goodbye. The deaf community said goodbye. Last night, the Red Lake Band, the veterans, the Center for Victims of Torture, the Class of 97 said goodbye. Last night, in the ways human bodies will do because of wars that have little or everything to do with them, flowers lay in piles on the sidewalk and clinging to the chain-link fence. Last night, in the silence and the flicker of one life here, one life gone, hope came out from waiting, where it always stands, between the flowers and the flames, between the guilty and the blameless, between letters and words and people holding hands or nothing at all. Last night, in the shadows and the cold, where people stood against the shadows. Last night, in the cold, such silences exhumed all knowledge of flames. The brief candle, who here, who suddenly gone, who so able to be lain as flowers now lay strewn about the sidewalks of testimony that would tell in many languages, construct a meaning able to serve when asked, what has happened? What is happening now, as wars that have everything and nothing to do with them wax on around a world whose hope waits quietly between the flowers and flames, between the candles and messages, between the human and the inhumane, the steady stream, the hot tear, the one heart, fragile, whispering in all of us, wanting to know, what in your grief will you say you are witnessing? Again, that's a poem that I wrote for the late Senator Paul Wellstone. Memorial, University Avenue, St. Paul, from my book, Homefront.
Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and its adventure, and its being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story. We have met Billy, sitting on the hillside overlooking the big lake, having escaped the group home, sitting by himself thinking his own thoughts. And Billy has now met Venom.
Venom brushed a curly lock from his face with a hairy, thick hand. Billy saw the zigzaggy tattoo in the middle of Venom's forehead. It was homemade. It looked kind of like that one part of the thunder and lightning tattoo that one big kid in Billy pointed. Venom felt his forehead and ran a finger perfectly along the lightning shaft, zigzag, like you could feel the ink. Harry Potter, he said. Billy smiled and let out a little chuckle. Right, muttered Billy the Kid. Then he saw the puppy in Venom's other hand, pressed into the ground under the brush. They're looking for me, said Venom. I killed lots of people. He looked at the stuffed bulldog like a lion might consider a dead eland in its paws to say, wake up, let's play. Me too, Billy shot in as soon as Venom took a damn breath. A car, an SUV, and semi-truck and electric company truck tires on the highway roared together like lions headed their way. Then they turned on the curve, roared away, and fell silent. Another bunch started this way, whining, shrieking, moaning, screaming, dying. Again, fighting their killers, fighting, dying. Venom wore a blue flannel shirt, jeans, brown belt, and black dress shoes from Goodwill with brown shoestrings. Billy knew the brand. In his left hand, the hand on the ground, low to the grass, Venom gripped the dirty, well-used toy bulldog wearing a black hockey helmet and a golden maroon UMD letter sweater that he had not stopped gripping tight ever since he and Billy had been talking. Billy hoped they would not have to go through how Venom had caught the dog and killed it and dressed it in clothes and stuffed it. Billy tilted his head so he could recall where he had seen Venom before. On TV. On the television at 404 Place Street, 55899, Rico's house. the W-2 game, baseball. You watch the other kids play, and all the players were characters made to look like some of the kids or some of the staff. Some of the old kids who'd been there a long time ago. Some of the old staff. One was Jesus playing center field. And one of them looked just like Venom, a caveman. Kind of like on that one commercial about something. He put up a hand and smiled at the thought and began to call out to tell him, then saw the dead stuffed puppy with stains on its chest, caught in old Venom's grip, and decided not to say any. Boom! Venom disappeared into the grass, and Billy slithered and dived over the side of the rock. Billy peeked up and looked out at the water at the shipboat, and it was not there. In the air were bits of white gold up high, spreading out. They floated down all around him. They were like gold dust disguised as snow. The ship must have been carrying gold, and it exploded. It exploded from a pirate grenade or cannon. There were pirates right now trying to take the gold from the ship, and that's what Billy was going to do. Billy heard tires skidding and slamming into a curb and car doors slamming. He heard voices and running through the grass. Billy! Hey, Billy! William! Hey!
That's the news from Duluth, Minnesota, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We're allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There's no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing the United States politicians, journalists, and generals who brought about this long 12-year war and debacle to trial and put on TV, just like OJ, every afternoon so every American can watch, just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now we live on lies, we subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden. They all know that. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to hear their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. Our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. That's someone's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They're not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face to face with the empire, those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. He's complicit. He's lied. He's continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. He lied right to our faces on national television when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea Osama bin Laden was buried at sea and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. See? There is a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. It went all the way into that hole. And no, there's no blood and bodies and no luggage scattered. No plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government, like a horror movie, and the killer is in the same house with us. The killers are right here with us. And they want us to be afraid. We cannot be afraid. Thank you and good night, Mike.
Thanks to our guests, Phil Ferruccio, Karen Kutkowski, who couldn't make it, but thank you anyway for trying, Michael Annis, Steve Collett. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to theshow.newamericandream.info. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artisan Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at looserock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrubyridge.com. To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave handy campfire rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-sized Obamaville Tom Jefferson rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. nwestiowa@gmail.com. And good night to my friends, Chuck Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And so good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.